welcome to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing nonprofits, social justice, and activism. Right here on CITR 101.9 FM, in Vancouver, of course. I am your host, Ethan Clow. Welcome to the show. Thank you for being here. I hope you've had an excellent week. It's been, well, a very busy week in the realm of nonprofits and social justice. From the Conservative government's ramming down the throat of Canadian politics, the Fair Elections Act, to scheduling conflicts on your favorite podcast and radio show here on The Sector. Now, last week I mentioned that we would be having Francois Holland from Dying with Dignity as a guest here on the show, but scheduling, planning didn't quite come through the way we were hoping. So, unfortunately, Francois will not be joining us on today's episode. However, we are very happy to have with us Mr. Brad Peters of Dying with Dignity. He is a volunteer with the organization and volunteers out of their Edmonton chapter. So we'll be talking with him later in the show about what it's like to volunteer with Dying with Dignity and what his personal thoughts are on volunteering in general and how volunteers sort of shape the nonprofit sector. So stay tuned for that. It's going to be very excellent. And of course, we will have the big question of the week, where we will dive into the question that I posed last week here on The Sector and examine it, think about it, perhaps even change some minds. And of course, we'll also introduce this week's new big question. And we'll get Brad's take on this whole subject of donations and giving and for a first-time donor, how much is an appropriate amount to give to charity? So we'll pick his brain on that a little bit later on in the show. Remember, if you would like to participate in the big question, or even just communicate with us here on The Sector, you can do so in several different ways. You can visit us online at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. You can visit us on Facebook, which is facebook.com/sectorpodcast. Or, of course, you can follow us on Twitter, at sectorpodcast. Or you can even follow me at Ethan Clow. And of course, if you want to email us here at The Sector, we are at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. So send us your comments, send us your criticisms. We can take it. Let us know what you think about our big question, and indeed, the show itself. There is a lot happening in the nonprofit sector, and all the better to talk about it, to open up conversations about what's going on out there and what you all think about it. And of course, social justice is a big part of the sector. There are several key issues right now that I'd like to discuss here on the show of a political nature, but also I think very relevant to both the question of civil liberties and what it means to be a free democratic society. Now, I already mentioned the recent political news with the Conservative government ramming through this new Fair Elections Act. And you might say, well, what is the Fair Elections Act? And that doesn't that sound good? Isn't that a good thing to have fair elections? Well, yes and no. We'll take a look at that in a bit more detail. There's another important issue that's on the radar for a lot of people right now, and that is net neutrality. And you might be saying, net neutrality, what is that? I thought neutrality was a good thing. We don't want net warfare, do we? Net warfare. Sorry, it's early in the morning for me. I'll get into net neutrality as well. And just, again, I want to raise awareness of some of these issues and their importance to, again, a free and democratic society. And that's what we want here on The Sector. And of course, that's what you want too, right? So stay tuned. We'll have a quick break and then we'll come back with some controversial discussions of political issues. Should be exciting.
Well, how best to explain it? You've seen me in X-Men.
Yeah.
The character I am, Professor Charles Xavier. Mm. If you remember, he can control things with the power of his mind. Can make people do things and see things. So I thought, what if you can do that for real? I mean, not in a comic book world, but in the real world.
All right.
So in my film, I play a man who controls the world with his mind.
Right. That's interesting.
Yeah, for instance, I'm walking along. And I see this beautiful girl, and I think I'd like to see her naked, and so all her clothes fall off.
All her clothes fall off?
Yes, and she's scrabbling around to get them back on again, but even before she can get her knickers on, I've seen everything. You know, I've seen it all.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. We've already seen everything.
Okay. It's a comedy, is it?
No.
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
And we're back here on The Sector on CITR with your host, Ethan Clow, me. So before the break, I mentioned the passing of what's called the Fair Elections Act. Now, this innocent-sounding bill may make you think, well, this is actually pretty good, fair elections. I'm in favor of fair elections. But in reality, this controversial bill is anything but fair. Often criticized, this bill has the potential to limit voter turnout here in Canada and tip the scales in terms of who votes, when they vote, where they vote, and how they vote. Now, this all may sound philosophical in terms of what may happen or what will happen, but the reality is that many Canadians, many political figures in Canada have come out to say that the Fair Elections Act can be a major blow to democracy in this country. Some of the controversial elements of this bill include removing the ability to vouch. Now, if you've ever worked in an election at one of the polling stations, you're familiar with vouching. That's where somebody comes in and says, I don't have ID, I don't have documentation on me at the moment, but my friend, or in most cases, a spouse or family member who does, is able to vouch for them and state that I declare that this person is who they say they are, that they're legally allowed to vote in Canada, and that they will do so. And it's basically a way for people who don't have the relevant documentation to still participate in democracy, which, as you would probably would guess, is kind of important to the whole process of an election. Now, you might think, but if you don't have the documentation, isn't that a possibility for voter fraud? Well, it very well could be, assuming that the person in question actually wasn't qualified to vote, and they did anyway. Because then, you know, all hell would break loose, because then you would have too much democracy. Is that a problem? I mean, like, let's just honestly think about this for a moment. Suppose people who do vouch as a way of voting, they vote. What is the downside? Now, I realize that you have to be a Canadian citizen, and there are reasons for that. You know, you don't necessarily want a bunch of people from outside the country to come in and vote and sway an important election. But are we that concerned? I mean, is there a big threat that a huge population of Americans is going to come up north and, you know, screw with our democracy somehow? You know, I don't think that that's a big issue, given the voter turnout in America isn't much better than it is here in Canada. So, I mean, if we're asking ourselves, why is vouching sort of this huge issue? Well, the fact is, there's a lot of people who do vouch to vote. Now, you might say, maybe there is a problem with vouching. Maybe it's so often done that governments have discovered that it actually is swaying our elections. Well, it turns out that roughly 120,000 people voted via vouching in our last election. That's about 1%. So, the Conservative government is concerned that about 1% of the population who votes may be committing voter fraud. And as we all know, that 1%, they're a tricky lot. So this bill will make it impossible for them to vote. Now you might say, well, they probably just forgot their documentation. And in some cases, that's absolutely true. But in many cases, a person vouches not because they're lazy or they don't have documentation or they're a criminal. They do so because of real problems that they simply can't solve in short notice. So for example, if you move to a new province, to a new city, or if you're a student, or if you're becoming a citizen, these are some of the reasons why it's difficult to have the documentation that you need to vote. Another problem, maybe you don't speak English. Maybe you're an immigrant. Now, maybe you've come to this country, you've taken the steps to become a citizen, but maybe you're also 75 years old, maybe you're 85 years old, maybe a lot of this process is confusing to you, and you don't speak English as a first language. It's a bit tough for you to navigate these rules, get all the documentation you need, go down to the voting booth, and cast your ballot. Now, you might say, well, tough beans. These people should learn the system. Maybe they should learn the system. Maybe we should be more direct and more clear in making sure that people who don't speak English as a first language or are immigrants to Canada or perhaps just elderly and may not understand the rules as clearly as we would like them to, maybe we should be more clear to them about what it takes to vote in Canada. But think about it. We're talking about 1% of the people who vote. And I keep coming back to this question, is it bad that more people vote, even if they technically shouldn't? Is that terrible for our democracy? I would wager, and I would suggest, that it's not. That more democracy, more voting, is always a good thing. Now, there are a lot of issues with the Fair Elections Act unrelated to vouching. For example, new rules related to fundraising for political parties. New rules related to what the chief electoral officer is allowed to say. New rules related to how Elections Canada promotes voting. And perhaps more controversial, the new rules that impose penalties and restrictions on Elections Canada providing information on where to vote. So there's a lot of aspects here, and I guess we don't have time to go into them all right now, but I do encourage listeners, learn more about the Fair Elections Act. At this point, it's not going to be stopped. However, I think it is important to keep an eye on the public perception of what this bill is doing to our system and how as we as Canadians need to respond to this. And we need to respond to this by electing parties that respect democracy. So that's my political statement for the week. Stay tuned. We have more here on The Sector after this.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, the Rumpus Room, the Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus. Go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling. Keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure.
federal government is trying to ram through a set of electronic surveillance laws that will invade your privacy and cost you money. The plan is to force every phone and internet provider to surrender our personal information to authorities without a warrant. The worst part of their invasive, all-encompassing surveillance scheme is that you have to pay for it out of your own pocket. Send Ottawa a message by signing the petition at stopspying.ca. That's www.stopspying.ca. Thank you.
And we're back on The Sector here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver with me, Ethan Clow, your host. So we were just talking about the Fair Elections Act, which has been rammed through by the Conservative government here in Canada. And this Fair Election Act proposing radical changes to Canadian democracy, which I have argued is much for the worst. Now, there's another area of social justice that I wanted to mention briefly, but I think it's no less important, and that is net neutrality. And you may have heard about this recently. It's pretty important. Now, we all think of the internet as sort of a series of tubes or lines, connections, interconnections across the planet. And information moves through these tubes. It's quite simple, really. And everyone, all these tubes, have the same amount of space. So everybody's information travels at about the same speed. That means whether you're watching a video on YouTube or you're watching a video on the lesser-known Tube Town, I just made that up, it's not real. But let's suppose it was. Let's suppose that there is YouTube and TubeTown. One of them is owned by a large conglomerate internet company, and one of them is sort of operated by like a mom-and-pop style little internet provider store place kind of person. Now, let's say that YouTube has all kinds of policies and agreements and arrangements with big production companies so that they can show things like clips from The Simpsons and movies and trailers and music. And TubeTown doesn't. TubeTown maybe focuses more on critical commentary, maybe news commentary, for example. Now, let's suppose that net neutrality is lost. And you might say, well, what does that even mean? Well, basically, it means that internet providers would be able to create what's called different lanes of the internet. You would have a fast lane and a slow lane. And you might say, well, what's the problem with that? Well, if you have a fast lane and a slow lane, they can sell the fast lane to the big companies like YouTube and force the small places like TubeTown to use the small lane. And again, why is this important? Well, one might argue that this would allow the big companies to basically muscle out of town the small companies. So YouTube could go on producing music and trailers and movies and all that great stuff, but maybe the quality starts to dip. Maybe people start tuning in to TubeTown. A lot of people. A whole lot of people. Suddenly, TubeTown is almost as popular as YouTube. But they don't have the infrastructure and the backing and the money to pay for these fast internet lanes, and YouTube does. So YouTube is able to purchase these lanes, put the squeeze on this new up-and-coming site that's, you know, threatening their advertising and their business model, and before you know it, TubeTown's out of business. So that's an extreme example, but essentially speaking, net neutrality ensures that the internet is free. It's democratic in that sense. Everybody has an equal chance to produce content. Users like us can surf and search around to their heart's content, and we're not punished for preferring that small little tube town to YouTube. But without net neutrality, with fast lanes and slow lanes, we are forced to rely on slower internet if we want to watch TubeTown instead of YouTube. There's a lot of great content out there already about net neutrality, so I don't want to go into it too much, and I don't want to repeat what's already out there and what's been said more eloquently than I can say it. So I'll leave some show notes up on the website. I encourage you to check it out. And again, net neutrality is going to be an ongoing fight. I mean, there's a good chance that regardless of what happens in the next couple of days, we may be facing an uncertain future with the internet. But ultimately, if we're more informed, if we're more aware, then all the better for us. Because then there's more that we can do to make the internet free and enjoyable for all of us. Even those of us who aren't a corporate conglomerate. Let's take one more quick break here on the show. When we come back, we'll have our interview with Brad Peters from Dying with Dignity, and we'll talk about volunteering and the organization Dying with Dignity and what they're all about there. Stay tuned.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
So vote.
CITR, 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
Joining us now on The Sector is Brad Peter. Brad is a volunteer with Dying with Dignity Canada. Brad, welcome to the show, and thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us a bit about your role with Dying with Dignity.
Yeah, so like you said, I am a volunteer. I consider myself a volunteer kind of in two regards. So I'll volunteer for the broader organization if they ever have any requests or need for volunteers. But just recently, myself and a couple other volunteers created a chapter in Edmonton. And so we kind of develop events and respond to requests more at the local level.
And so tell us a bit about the Edmonton chapter. What kind of local tasks do you take on? Fundraising, activism, and what sort of tasks do you like to take on personally?
Yeah, well, my primary interest is actually in acting as a speaker. So either creating and delivering presentations or workshops or responding to media requests, maybe. As a chapter, we're really interested in creating more awareness around the issue. We're interested in gaining new members, in fundraising. So we'll take on a whole number of things, but primarily we're looking for opportunities to speak to the general public.
Excellent. Well, tell us a bit about the organization Dying with Dignity, and what is the message that you guys promote and put out there to the public?
Yeah, Dying with Dignity is a national charitable organization. They have chapters all across Canada. And the mission really is to improve Canadians' quality of dying and to expand the end-of-life options available in Canada. So they really achieve this three main ways. They have the one portion, which is education. So educating people about patient rights and the importance of advanced care plans, where they provide support to patients or families of patients who are dealing with end-of-life issues. And the main thing people know Dying with Dignity for is their role in providing information as to why physician-assisted dying should be legalized in Canada. So they really tackle a range of issues, but they're most known for, I think, for that physician-assisted dying legislation.
And maybe tell us a bit about why that particular cause is important for Canadians to be aware of, and what do you think it means for someone to know that they maybe have that option as opposed to not having that option?
Right. You know, I've seen firsthand the impact that not understanding your rights as a patient and not having an advanced care plan and, of course, not having physician-assisted dying can have in terms of your quality of dying and your quality of life at the end of life. I really think that every single day we go by without physician-assisted dying legislation, more and more Canadians with incurable illnesses suffer agonizing and needless suffering against their wishes. So to me, I really hope that if I ever find myself in a situation where I have a serious incurable illness, that I'll be granted some choice at life. And I think that's something that is really important to all Canadians, and all Canadians should want autonomy at the end of life.
Great. Well, let's talk a bit about how the organization works. So how does Dying with Dignity get funded? Are you primarily through donations from the public, or grants, or other sources?
Yeah, actually, the bulk of our funding is through donations. And then a little bit of the funding, or I guess the next biggest chunk of our funding, is through membership fees. And really, those two things combined are the majority of the funding that Dying with Dignity receives.
And so on the show today, we've been talking about first-time gifts and what an appropriate amount is for someone to give when they've first encountered a charity and they're wanting to make a contribution. So for Dying with Dignity and for yourself, what do you think is an important way of sort of stewarding a first-time gift to make sure that it's not only a first-time gift, that it becomes a regular contribution, or that somebody feels like their donation is going into a good cause and is being looked after in a good way?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think trying to get people to donate multiple times, I think what the organization can do is honestly just make it easy. If someone goes onto your website to make a donation, and there's no option for them to have that donation automatically repeated once a year, then they're probably much less likely to sign back on in a year and remember to make that donation. So I think as an organization, make it as easy as possible. And I know Dying with Dignity has an option on their website where you can just sign up for an annual donation really easily. It's just a checkbox. And so having that option there, I think, takes a lot of the work out of, or takes a lot of the work away from the volunteers or the donors who would have to every year pull out their credit card, type all the numbers into the computer, and make that donation. So as an organization, all I can say is make it easy.
Great. Excellent. So with the mission of Dying with Dignity, obviously, there's lots of strong emotions about this issue. How do you go about presenting it to people in a way to keep them both interested, but not offend them or push them away or frighten them, but to inform them and maybe even convince them? Perhaps they don't necessarily agree with the mission, but how would you go about convincing somebody that this is an important issue?
Right. Yeah, it is a very emotional issue. I don't know many other issues where the presenter and the audience is crying within the first 5 minutes of a talk. So it's highly emotional. But I think with this issue, it's actually really important that you appeal to people on that level, because somebody coming to your presentation might be wary because they don't understand where you're coming from or what your motives are. So one thing that I like to do is start a presentation with a just quick 5-minute personal story. And if you can appeal to people on that level, if they can understand that you're coming to this from a place of compassion, I think that's really important. Or you can flip it around and you can have the people who are at your presentation share some of their personal stories so that you can really empathize with them. And it just makes the material that you're going to discuss later that much more relative to them. And so, you know, it is very emotional, but I think you really have to use that to your advantage almost. What's interesting with this issue, I find, is that while it is very emotional, it can also be very cerebral. So if you're not appealing to someone on that level, maybe they don't have a personal experience with this, you can talk about all the medical research that supports this. You can talk about statistics from other jurisdictions. These are a lot of evidence-based arguments that we're talking about. So you can really flip it to a cerebral thing so that the emotional side of thing, maybe it's a little too raw for people. You can still really appeal to them with this issue.
Excellent. And so what sort of methods do you find work best for education?
I like to give direct presentations. So instead of just handing materials out or something like that, I think there's a lot of value in actually talking to people. We find when we put together maybe a 30-minute PowerPoint presentation, it turns into a two-hour discussion because people have so many questions and people want to share their stories. So really interacting with people, I think, is the most effective way to get a message across and to help them understand the issue.
And with sort of the changing forms of technology that nonprofits have at their disposal these days, Twitter, social media, Facebook, do you find that advanced technology like this can help you guys? I mean, we've all heard about the mistakes made with social media by nonprofits and charity that actually really hurt their cause. Mm-hmm. So how do you balance that? And do you see a role for Twitter and Facebook and this cause?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Dying with Dignity does a really good job of utilizing Facebook and Twitter. As well, they have a blog that emails updates to members every day so people can stay really current with issues. Another thing is, I think it's important for charities to have guidelines on social media policies. I think it would be unfortunate today if someone didn't utilize those resources because they were worried about violating the rules that a charity has to follow. So as an organization, if you can create some guidelines for your members, I think that's really key and allows you to be really effective with your social media.
And sort of speaking on the subject of social media, who do you find is your most receptive audience? I mean, we think of social media as being used by young kids and Generation Y and whatnot. But do you find that you're actually reaching a totally different demographic than you thought you would with social media or even just with your presentations?
Yeah, I think just the nature of the topic, you automatically appeal to an older generation. And so a lot of people who follow Dying with Dignity's social media are older than you might expect to find on Facebook. So that's really interesting. And I know as a chapter, when we get presentation requests, we've had presentation requests from religious groups, and then on the opposite end of the spectrum, we've presented to an atheist club, we've presented to a pride society. So there's a huge range of people who are actually interested in this topic. I don't think this topic, because it's so universal, necessarily appeals to one group over the other. Maybe with the age, you do get the older people, but other than that, it's pretty well spread across the board.
And do you think maybe a lot of that has to do with the connection to civil liberties and social justice that, as you say, it can appeal to religious people, non-religious people, different branches of the population are all sort of interested in it for perhaps a different reason, a different angle. What's been your experience with that?
I think, and it's unfortunate, most people don't come to this issue until they've had maybe a really tragic experience in their life with a loved one dying or a family member dying. When you experience that, you suddenly become aware of this whole other world, this whole issue that exists. And so I think that's why it appeals to such a broad range of people, is because nobody is immune to death, and so it's something that affects all of us. Illness is something that affects all of us. So it's really more of a universal issue.
And you mentioned speaking to different groups, religious groups, atheist groups. Do you have to do a lot of tailoring to your presentations to make it appropriate for different groups, or do you find that it's as you say, like a universal topic, and that you don't feel the need to frame it in any kind of particular fashion?
Yeah, I think it's really not a topic that has to be framed in a religious or non-religious context. I think once you just present the facts, share some stories, this would appeal to anyone, really. There's nothing inherent about this issue that should rub anyone the wrong way. So When I presented to both groups, I really didn't change my presentation at all. You definitely maybe get a different type of question from different groups, but in terms of the material, I think it's important to share the exact same material and share the same message to everyone.
Excellent. So where do you see Dying with Dignity going in the next 5 years?
Well, I'm excited because I really think in Canada that assisted dying legislation is right on the horizon, and Dying with Dignity is going to be there every step of the way. So I'm excited to see them kind of work with lawmakers in developing this type of legislation. But in the long run, I think there's always going to be a need for advocating for palliative care, for educating people on their rights as a patient. So I think in some ways, Dying with Dignity will continue doing what it's doing, but in other ways, there are some exciting things up ahead with this legislation.
Great. Well, let's talk a bit about volunteering. So why do you volunteer in general?
Well, for this topic, it's something that is really close to my heart. I volunteer with Dying with Dignity because it's something that affected my family. I really want to make sure that nobody else, including myself, has to experience what my family members experienced in long-term care. My grandma spent an entire year physically incapacitated in long-term care, dying of cancer. And this was a really agonizing process. It was so tragic that people who lead such beautiful lives have to suffer such barbaric deaths. And I've seen that, you know, understanding your rights as a patient, having an advanced care plan, and having this legislation, this would make such a huge impact on people's lives. So I volunteer because it's something that is really close to my heart. I certainly wouldn't be as motivated to help out if it wasn't something I believed in so strongly.
And how does the organization go about finding new volunteers and not just bringing them on board, but also informing them and training them and teaching them about these topics and these issues?
Yeah, I think the volunteer recruitment is actually, it's almost more passive, because I think most people probably hear about Dying with Dignity through the media, through interviews and through the news. And then once a volunteer becomes interested, they would probably get involved at the local chapter level. So it's really important to have chapters really spread out across Canada, so that once you have someone interested, they have something to do, they have people to go to. And Dying with Dignity has been really great in that they make excellent use of webinar software. So they can host speaker training sessions all across Canada from their office in Toronto or Vancouver. So using the webinars, I think, is a really effective tool and is a great way for reaching all of your volunteers. So everyone's getting the same message and everyone has access to such great training.
Excellent. And how does Dying with Dignity divide tasks and work among staff and volunteers? Is it an even split, or do volunteers get sort of a different sort of task than, say, a paid staff person would?
Yeah, I think the organization has actually very few paid staff, and they really keep the charity going. They manage their social media, and they deal with memberships and stuff like that. And then it's really up to the volunteers who are the ones spreading that message. I know our executive director is all over the country all the time doing as much as she possibly can to spread this message, but it's hard when you have such few staff. So I think volunteers, that's really where they come in, is that education and outreach portion of it.
And as you probably know, it's such a difficult task for volunteers. I mean, balancing work and life and then volunteering. So what are some of the ways that Dying with Dignity can show them that they're appreciated and basically make sure that they feel comfortable and happy and satisfied with their role?
Yeah, we have frequent meetings. So We form these chapters, and the chapters are a little bit self-governing, so they can kind of determine what tasks they want to do. They're not necessarily being told to do this event and that event. It's really up to the chapters to create events that they find meaningful and that they're willing to take on. So as an broader organization, they do host regular check-ins with chapters where we can all kind of chat together and share ideas. So I think that's really important to make sure that you're still being connected with the broader organization and the chapters aren't kind of left on their own.
And do you think, is there any risk or difficulty, given the fact that Diamond Community could be seen as sort of a controversial organization in recruiting people or even retaining volunteers who might feel a bit nervous about talking about volunteering with an organization like Dying with Dignity?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't think it's necessarily as controversial as people think. When we look at public opinion polls, we see that an overwhelming majority of Canadians are actually in support of this issue, but you're absolutely right. It is such an emotional issue. I think for some volunteers, they're maybe held back a bit because it brings back a lot of difficult memories for them. They aren't comfortable getting up in front of a group of people and talking about these personal experiences. So I think for sure the emotional side of things can really limit what a volunteer is comfortable doing. I know personally a lot of people, when I talk to them about Dying with Dignity or they find out I volunteer, they seem very hesitant. And I'm not sure if that's because maybe just the topic of death is uncomfortable for a lot of people. I know it's not something we talk a lot about in Canada. Or possibly that they realize that because you volunteer with this organization, you probably have a personal experience and maybe they're uncomfortable getting into that. So there is a little bit of I don't know, hesitation when you talk to some people about this organization. And for sure with our volunteers, I know a lot of them are hesitant to talk about their own personal experiences. So it's interesting, but you know what? There's a lot of people who are such great speakers and are so willing to share these painful stories, and I'm so grateful for those people.
And I imagine that in a way, it's about perhaps breaking down a social taboo that maybe we have here in Canada about a fear of discussing death and discussing the sort of end of life time that we will have all we will all face it, but by doing so we build a more open society, we build a more comfortable society where we can make improvements to these sort of issues.
Oh, I agree absolutely. And actually there's a new kind of thing happening called death cafes where people can meet up for coffee and talk about these difficult issues, talk about death and dying. And so I hope that we're getting to a place in Canada where it's not so taboo, where people are much more open about this issue, because I think it's really important.
Great. So just maybe to follow up on some of the cultural issues, maybe to go in sort of a political direction, what kind of successes have you found with advocating for political or legislative changes? How does that process work, and what are your thoughts on that going into the future?
Yeah, I think as a charity, you always have to make sure that you're, of course, within the bounds of what you can do. And I think understanding what the rules are around political activity is really key. So as an organization, having a strong allowable political activity guideline is really key, because then you can be really effective in terms of every time something happens in the media, you can write a letter of support to maybe your MLA or your MP. I think that is huge, and we need people to do that. Another thing is just having a discussion with an MLA or MP. Making that personal connection is really key. So I think there's a couple little things you can do that are so important and that people maybe don't realize that charities are allowed to do. So really understanding what you're allowed to do and doing that to the best of your abilities, I think, is really important. And I think Dying with Dignity does such a great job of that.
Excellent. Well, as we are wrapping up here, let's go on to one of our favorite questions here in the sector, and that is the pitch of the week. And this is where we ask our guests for their best elevator pitch, or maybe a short 30-second to a minute pitch for a charity or a cause of their choice. So Brad, what would be your pitch of the week?
Yeah, I mean, if I had an opportunity to talk to someone, I would want to advocate for physician-assisted dying legislation. And I think what I would do is just pull out a photo of my grandma from my wallet and say, you know, this is someone who had such a beautiful life. She had 3 children and 9 grandchildren who loved her so much. And we were all forced to watch as our laws forced her to suffer such an agonizing and prolonged death in a hospital. You know, all we want is the option to die in a way that respects and reflects the dignity that we carried within our lives. So I plead, you know, please support our right to choice. It's just a right to choose to die with dignity. That's all we're asking for.
Well said. So, Brad, for anyone who is interested in getting involved, perhaps volunteering or donating, where should they go for that?
Definitely the website. The Dying with Dignity website has a lot of great educational materials, membership forms. As well, you can download advanced care plan templates that are specific to each province. So check out www.dyingwithdignity.ca for more information.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Brad. And please visit us again in the future on the sector.
Thank you so much.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an all that Peter is gold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on, get up.
And we're back on the sector. Our thanks to Brad for joining us on the show to discuss Dying with Dignity as an organization and what it's like to volunteer with them. We'll have links in our show notes to Dying with Dignity, so if you want to learn more about their organization or how to donate to Dying with Dignity, we'll have that information for you. Well, the show has really flown by today, I think a large part because, well, I ranted and raved at the start of it, but a good rant is, well, it's important to have one every now and then, and I think that I've earned it. It is, after all, my show. Well, I wanted to get to the big question a lot earlier, but since we're here right now, let's discuss it. Last week, I posed the question, what is an appropriate amount to give as your first donation to an organization that you've just encountered? Let's think for a moment and pretend that you're at home and your phone rings and it's one of those telephoning fundraisers that we've discussed previously on the show. And they ask you to make a donation to a cause. And let's assume for a moment that you hear them out and you actually say to yourself, you know, this is an important cause. I can get behind this. How much should you give? Now let's assume that we're not rich. We're not one of those wealthy 10%ers. So we're probably thinking to ourselves, okay, well, anywhere between $10 and $100 is somewhere on that spectrum of potential gifts. So how do we determine what is the appropriate amount? I mean, caution being what it is, we're probably not going to give on the high side of that. We, after all, I mean, maybe we've looked them up, maybe we know a bit more about them, but at the same time, we're probably a little bit wary. We don't want to give too much money away to what could potentially be a scam. Not that we're accusing them of being a scam, but you know, being safe is important. Now, on the other hand, we're probably not going to give on the low end of the spectrum because, well, we're not that cheap, and we do think it's important, and we do know that $10 or $5 is That's fairly low for a charity, and we want them to be able to work with something here. So most people would probably fall somewhere around the 25 to 50, maybe a bit more. Now you might think to yourself, I bet I'll give more next year, or later on in the year, or whatever it might be. It turns out that a lot of people try what we like to think of as a test run. That is, we make a donation around $50, $60, and we want to see how the charity responds. A lot of times, it's a question of how is that information, or how is that donation, and how is our information processed? Do we get put on mailing lists? Do we get phone calls every 3 weeks? Are we suddenly getting flyers and other charities' flyers in the mail? Are we getting phone calls all the time asking for more donations? This kind of pestering is obviously not what we want, and that's going to impact any kind of future giving. But maybe we want some recognition. Maybe we get a phone call for just to say thanks, or we get a special present in the mail, like one of those calendars or a pen, or a little thank you note with a card. Those can go a long way in making someone feel appreciated as a donor. A lot of times, a first-time donor is motivated to donate because of some specific cause. You're told about an initiative to build a shelter for stray animals, or an initiative to purchase some library books, or an initiative to build a new facility for an organization. So, an update, a progress report on that particular cause can go a long way into making us feel like we've donated to something that's worth our time. In this sense, whatever it is that we're donating to, we're testing out the charity. We're seeing how they respond to us. We're seeing how they steward us, how they respond to our donation, respond to us, and put our money to good use. If we're satisfied, we may donate it again. We may become a repeat donor, somebody who donates every year. So we can expect a phone call sometime between October and December for their winter fundraising campaign. And it's always sort of the same thing. You know, we'll talk for a little bit. They'll say, we really appreciate your past support. Would you like to donate again this year? And we'll say yes. Maybe after a couple of years of this, they might ask us to become monthly givers. So we give maybe a small amount, like $5 once a month for a whole year. Monthly giving is what fundraisers know to be the most lucrative form of fundraising there is. Because monthly givers usually become very invested in the organization. They want to follow along. They want to know what's going on. And monthly givers, some of them, become planned givers. That's where you make a donation in your will. So you decide to give maybe 10% of your estate when you've passed away to an organization, and it's a fantastic way to give a large amount of money to an organization and, you know, do a lot of really good with what you have left in life. Planned giving is one of the most lucrative, perhaps lucrative sounds bad, but it is one of the best ways for charities to fundraise. When we're kind of uncomfortable with talking about death and giving while dead, but it actually makes a huge difference. And nonprofits and charities put a lot of effort into making people feel comfortable and secure with giving to them through their estate when they pass away. It's a very important aspect of the fundraising process. And monthly giving, that's where you find the people who are most likely to give to a charity. To make their gift transition from a monthly gift to an estate gift, to a final gift. So it's kind of interesting to think about, isn't it? That you may get a phone call one day from an organization, perhaps you have heard of them, perhaps you haven't, and they talk to you. Maybe they ask you for a donation and you say no, but they call you next year and you think about it but say no, but then the third time you do. You donate $60. They respond, they send you a card, they call and thank you. Next year you donate again. pretty soon you're a monthly giver. And every month you donate $5 to this organization. And then years go by, maybe you increase your amount. And then it comes time to write your will. And you say, you know, I actually have a sizable estate. I mean, I'm not rich, but hey, I could actually make a pretty big contribution to a charity. So you give 10% of your estate to a charity. That could come out to a lot of money. So you can see that over the course of a person's lifetime, they could go from being a first-time giver of maybe 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 bucks, to by the end of it, they're giving in excess of hundreds of thousands of dollars in some cases. It's food for thought. Well, we are running out of time here on The Sector, and I don't have time to launch the new big question of the week. This is the first time we're not going to have a new big question. That's shocking. Wow. Well, nevertheless, let's think more about donating and giving. And what I've just sort of described here is what's called the donor pyramid. So for next week, let's dive into more donation talk. We'll talk about what it means to be on the donor pyramid, what it is, and perhaps, controversially, maybe this way of thinking about donations is all wrong. So we'll dive into that next week here on The Sector. Once again, thank you all for tuning in and listening to me rant about politics and net neutrality. And thanks to Brad for joining us from Dying with Dignity. If you want to learn more about The Sector, visit us online at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. We are on Facebook at facebook.com/sectorpodcast, as well as on Twitter at The Sector Podcast. And you can follow me on Twitter as well at Ethan Plow. Well, this is your host signing off for another week. See you all next Friday.
On who I am. What the fuck, man? Fucking prick. Oh yeah? Since when? Who the fuck are you, fool? You'll see. Fucking coward. You're a fucking hater. Fuck out of here. Enjoy hating, you prick. Oh good, you fucking idiot. You fucking with the wrong guy. Sucks to be you. Better watch yourself. Real talk.
Beaver Hour. Tuesdays at 11 p.m. Pacific Standard Time with your host, Emma Rawson.
Rawson.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at
The Baker and the Chef, Bangone T-Shirts, Cherry Bomb, House of Vintage, Beat Street Records, Downlevy Snack Bar, The Fall Tattooing, Fortune Sound Club, Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Perch, The Portside Pub, Save on Meats, Vinyl Records, and Zoo Shop.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus. Go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure, that's what friends are for.
Cut off both my hands and threw them in the sand. Why? watch them swim away from me like a pair of bloody crabs. Close my eyes and dream of different skies. Stare straight at the sun and try not to cry for you. Oh no. Doused in waves of stars.